Masculinity is a beautiful, powerful gift to humanity, but it's been under tremendous fire. I'm 100% of the belief that if we can heal and restore men to be good men, to be truly masculine men, whatever that means, and we'll talk about that, we can heal the nation and we can heal the world. I've got a fantastic guest today, one I've been really looking forward to talking to. Controversial looking character, but actually a heart of note and has done tremendous amount of work with men around South Africa and around the nation. Tulani Grenville Gray, he has a fascinating heritage, a mom who is Zulu, a father who is Eton educated English.
Tough. And
why do you call him?
No, I was going to say tough.
Tough. But he's been in South Africa for many, many years, a qualified psychologist and has done phenomenal work with men. You're with Craig Wilkinson and Tulani. This is Dangerous But Good. Tulani, just fantastic to have you here, brother. I must admit, when I first met you, you're an interesting character. You presented, your nails were painted and you had this kind of garb on. It's very hard to make out, who am I meeting here? But fantastic to have you on board.
I just have fun with fashion. I don't try to signal anything. I'm actually natural nails right now, that feels great. Yeah. I don't know what I was doing.
I feel more comfortable with it.
All right. I'm glad to be here, man. I mean, we've had our conversations. Eventually, I also pushed back.
Yeah,
like you say, I think it's our generation.
But I mean, you've done so much work with men. A lot of men who are HIV positive and around their treatment protocols. And I'd love to start off by asking you what have you found that really holds men back in this nation, that keeps them from stepping up to be who they were meant to be?
What holds them back? I'd go right back to the beginning. Yeah. And I think I often say this in the training, is that men have been sort of tacitly exposed to a prayer from day one. And that prayer goes something like, thou shalt not show your feelings at any time, especially when you're feeling the most threatened. That is the time not to show any vulnerabilities, especially to your friends. And I don't think anybody tells a young man that prayer, but it's so obvious and so they get that they can smell it, and then they act accordingly,
right?
Which means from day one, they're handicapped in terms of feeling integrated with all themselves, with the whole of themselves.
Right.
And I think it deprives them of developing a sort of self-esteem that's very solid, right? Yeah. And you wonder why all these incidences of absolute crazy violence. Mm. What is that about? And I sometimes liken it to it's like a runaway train.
Yeah.
And a runaway train, so there's no ballast, the ballast being self-esteem.
Right.
So if you get called an idiot or whatever, worse words, you know, men will just pop.
Yeah, it just triggers
because them. there's a lack of having developed that sense of self that can only come from experiencing vulnerabilities. And they don't know the language of vulnerability.
Right.
So they, as you know, men have a code. If I can see you're upset, we go for a beer.
Yeah.
At the end of the evening, you think I've supported you, but we don't literally have the language. So, so that's, I think, part of the problem is that they don't have that kind of thermostat, if you like, emotional thermostat.
Right.
Because they don't know the middle numbers. Do you know what I mean? They know 0 and 100.
Right, right.
Yeah.
So there's no release. There's no there's no outlet for what's been bottled up inside.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Well, there are outlets and they're bad ones.
They're bad ones.
They're violence. They're drinking.
I'm with you. But that self-esteem is interesting because if a man doesn't have self-esteem, any insult or any sign of disrespect, even a woman saying no to him, can trigger an angry response.
Yeah.
And it's coming out of woundedness, isn't it? It's coming out of hurt.
Sad, it always precedes anger. A lot of people forget that. In fact, the whole world is, you know, it's about sadness. It's about feeling sad. But most people jump from the sad to the angry.
Right.
And then we start getting into fights and then wars. And,
because we're not allowed to be sad as men, are we?
Nope.
Yeah. We're not allowed to be sad. If we were allowed to be sad, we could deal with it and overcome it.
Yeah.
I mean, your methodology is fascinating. I mean, as a psychologist, you've written programs.
Okay, just to clarify, I'm not a psychologist. I studied counseling psychology, but yeah.
Okay, right.
Some people are prickly about that.
That's right. Yeah. You have psychological insider knowledge.
Yeah.
But you've developed courses for men, which are quite, I wouldn't say controversial, but they're quite confrontational in a way. I mean, they really get down to the nitty-gritty of what's going on.
Yeah. Well, I'm not a believer. I call it pantomime. I don't believe in – I think we all play pantomimes to a certain extent, women, men, and religious people, political people. It's kind of like a pantomime. So, but I don't give any – we don't do pantomimes during the training. And
you mean we put on an act?
Yeah. So we sort of act manly or
– Right.
So we – a lot of the training breaks down that pantomime by creating a safe place, which is usually away from home. Right. And the best trainings we do are you know, off-site. They take a week.
Yeah.
So that you don't have to keep on going back into the pantomime. You know what I mean?
You can
experience all sorts of things. Then you go back to a place where you have to signal that you're tough and you're hard and you're, you know. When you say it's hard because it's the truth.
Down all of the facades, doesn't it?
Yeah.
Which I think if we've lived our entire life with this facade, you're almost unaware of the fact that it's a facade, isn't it?
Yeah. I mean,
this is just how you are.
Yeah.
This is your persona that you present to the world.
Yeah.
But you get beneath that and you cut through that.
Yeah. I mean, but also an important part is that you start with yourself, okay, your own biases. And you have to – I think that's a big factor in influencing these guys because, you know, you've met Silver. Myself and Silver, we model a kind of – friendship and brotherly love and vulnerability and bias, you know, and you've got to, I think, not got to, but it helps to check yourself.
Yeah.
And round every corner, there are times where you can show that bias. I've done it. I catch myself doing it, and it's embarrassing.
But you're self-aware to the point where when you do it, you can see yourself in the mirror.
Yeah,
I'm doing it. Yeah, and I mean, I think that's the starting point for any kind of healing or process of development, isn't it? Yeah. Looking in the mirror and seeing, hey, you know, I am biased.
But you've got to integrate it. Most people split it off.
Mm-hmm.
But the trick is to walk with it. And I describe mental health or well-being as I use this model of an iceberg.
Mm-hmm.
What's on top and what's beneath.
Right.
And often some people call it the conscious or the unconscious, but I just call it what you show the world and what you don't show the world.
Right.
And it's important that you understand that you're the whole iceberg. You're not just the top.
I'm with you.
Because there's so much underneath that if you don't acknowledge, mm-hmm. we'll have a mind of its own.
It drives what is displayed to the world.
Mm.
So what the tip of the iceberg, which is really, what one-ninth, something like that, is driven by what's underneath. But how much of what's underneath is the average person or man aware of that's driving this behavior that we're actually displaying to the world? How much of this shit that
lurks
beneath the ocean are we actually aware of?
I think, look, just even when I do the workshop and you say, okay, and you list it, what's mm-hmm. beneath? People know.
Yeah.
They, you know, lust, greed, all the stuff, anger, sadness, depression. I mean, they pop them out. People actually know. But just getting the insight that, look, those things are part of you and you need to speak to them.
Mm-hmm.
And then we move on to a trauma. Now, a trauma goes down quickly.
So before the lust would be a trauma, because often the lust and the whatever the anesthetics we use are basically anesthetics to deal with the trauma that came before them, would you say?
Explain a bit more.
Well, I mean, we use anesthetics such as drinking.
Right.
To mask.
Anesthetics, right, yeah.
To mask the pain.
Mm.
So the pain is I'm feeling inferior, I'm feeling useless, I'm feeling like, there's lots of alpha males around me and I'm a beta male, I'm never going to crack it, you know, so I need to drink to make myself feel good about myself.
Yeah.
Or, I mean, pornography is a tremendous escape into, you know, some kind of oxytocin, whatever is released illegitimately through that, but it becomes a real addiction. But it's often driven by something bigger than that or deeper than that.
And that's what I suppose that analogy of an iceberg is trying to say is that all those things are shoved underneath the surface.
Yeah.
And the analogy of an iceberg is so useful because there's flow between the top and the bottom. There's splashes, right? And there's ways that you can stay in touch with the bottom. Artistic pursuit is a big one. Sport, soccer, singing, dancing, all that stuff Because not all music is sweet and lovely.
No.
It's not all music is the top. You know what I mean? Not all sex is just the top, is sort of missionary. You know, like, so getting people in touch with the awareness that there's another side to them helps them. But then, like you say, beer, substances, they will reduce the flow between the top. And I use the analogy of it icing over.
Right.
The sea ices over, and then there's no access to that, and then it has a mind of its own.
Right. So the challenge to men, and we're talking about men because of the fact that women generally are more in touch with feelings and given permission more to be in touch with their feelings, and also the fact that men are driven more to express unexpressed emotions through anger, which can be very destructive. So we're talking about men.
Yeah.
So the challenge to men is get in touch with yourself, with the iceberg, the stuff that drives your life, your life journey. You know, a lot of the work we do with men, and you do exactly the same. So we get men to tell their story.
Yeah.
And every one of us has a story. And that story is sacred and beautiful, but it often is a story that has caused tremendous woundedness. And there's also a narrative about masculinity that we add to that story. Mm. So I'm feeling traumatized. I'm feeling less than. My self-esteem is in shatters and tatters because of the way I've been raised. But to be a man, I need to have sexual partners. I need to be powerful. I need that money. And it comes out in anger and destruction. And really the solution to that for me is to deal with the shit, deal with the wound, deal with the pain and the tragedy by bringing it out and then looking at what it actually means to be a man, not the lies about masculinity. Yeah.
So my problem, I struggle with the approach we're taking in South Africa, which is awareness. Stop GBV, stop GBV. I mean, we don't need to spend any more money on the awareness that GBV is a problem. Like you do with your camps, like we do with our trainings, you can say all this theoretically to a man.
Yeah.
You can say all this stuff. Oh, you're pushing things down, you're drinking together. You can say all that. It doesn't mean anything unless they experience that what you're saying, there is another person on the other side of that. And if that's time consuming, it's quite expensive, you know, and when we think about taking it to scale, all the campaigns in the world, all the GBV launches and awareness won't do anything.
Well, they're external, aren't they? They're imposing an external standard on someone who's struggling so much that even if there's punishment involved, then it's not going to fix them or change them. It's going to suppress. You know, I love what Stephen Covey said. He said, to the extent that a society has values, to the extent that a society doesn't have values, law is unenforceable. To the extent that a society does have values, law is not necessary.
Right.
And I think with regards to us as men, the more we have internal values which are driven by a healthy self-esteem, a healthy sense of self, a healthy sense of validity and legitimacy and belonging, plus a good understanding of what true masculinity is, and we'll get into that, which basically serves instead of dominates, which loves instead of hates, which shows care instead of anger. I mean, that is true masculinity. It's not lacking in power. It has tremendous power, but it uses the power for good. But to the extent that men are wounded and have a false idea of masculinity, no external imposition of you know, don't abuse a woman, that's not going to change because they know it's wrong. But they're driven by these forces that are almost unstoppable.
I think there's almost a case to be made to drop the term masculinity, almost. Because people say, well, do you train men? It's like, and I often joke, it's a half joke, but I say I turn men into people in the training. Mm-hmm. Because there's so many ghosts around that word masculinity that it sort of gets in the way of really reducing things down to basic personhood
or humanity.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So I think a lot of words like masculinity, even men, you know, I saw you one of your postcards, what is a man? That takes you down a road that may not be helpful because you're trying to squeeze a new way of thinking into an old word. It's like this idea of saying real men don't rape. That's a terrible, terrible message. Because you're reinforcing this real men idea, and the problem starts from people trying to be real men, you know?
Well, don't you think, I mean, maybe we slightly disagree with this, but I think in principle we agree. We need to reclaim what masculinity actually means. You know, if just because something's been distorted through misuse doesn't mean we abandon the word. For me, the words masculinity and man are beautiful words.
Yeah.
Beautiful words.
You know? I picked up on that. I like the way I like that approach.
Yeah.
I do agree with you. You are reimagining. You know, you're reimagining what...
Claiming in a way. Yeah. You know, I mean, there's this whole big movement. We need to redefine masculinity. I said, no, we need to rediscover it. You know, you can go back into the 1800s and see men treating women with tremendous respect and dignity. Mm. And you know, I mean, that's what... You know, you take the Titanic, you know. When the Titanic sank, do you know the stats? I mean, it's quite astonishing. There were far more men on the boat than there were women. But the percentage of men who drowned on their boat was way higher. I think 75%, whereas 19% of women. The reason? Men were giving up their places in the lifeboats. I mean, that's true masculinity. Mm. I mean, that's beautiful. That's men being true, real men in the proper sense of the word, not the distorted. You know, so for me, I deal a lot with young boys at schools too, and they're struggling with identity and they're struggling with legitimacy and validity. And I say to the guys, you know, in your DNA is a rich heritage of heroism. Mm. That's who you're designed to be.
Mm.
And that's what real masculinity is. So let's abandon this idea of macho masculinity. That's not real masculinity, or abusive masculinity, or dominant. You know, that's not it at all. Protective, loving, serving, caring masculinity, that's what it is. And I'm convinced, Tulani, we are striving for the same thing, to make men good men.
No, yeah, but exactly.
And human beings.
And how do we do that, though? I mean, I'm in agreement with that. But it's almost like I'm very real world and practical, right? It's like these like the group you had at the weekend, like our trainings, and it sometimes makes me wonder, because things can change within that week, can transform, but then the guys have got to go back into their communities. Do you know what I mean? And it's incredible the external pressure. It's like anything. It's about why people leave the country or move town, because you're already that persona.
Yeah.
And if you change it and you come back and change it, you're gonna have to push back against a hell of a lot of pushing you back into who you were. So I'm always mindful that, you know, and I've seen the transformation and it's jaw dropping. But I often wonder what happens when they go back.
Oh,
I mean, for example, we trained this bodyguard to a taxi owner, proper G, looking around. You know, I mean, very hyper aware, but his baseline was aggression, you know. And then after a week, we discovered, you know, he, from the age of 7, his dad had made him stick fight. All he had known is to be violent with men. And the word he used at the end of it in his reflections were, I've been robbed. You know, I've been robbed. My whole life I've been robbed by being squeezed into this thing. And, you know, me and Silver would laugh, like, I wonder what kind of bodyguard he's going to be now. Because, I mean,
he's
So I've seen that, but I'm curious what happens. What's the echo of our trainings? What is the real impact? And can we even measure it? Because, you know, you see, it's almost like a blossom. They flower during these things. They come back to themselves. Yeah. But then they go out.
Back into the scorching heat.
And I think a lot about the longevity, the sustainability of this kind of revelations that they have.
Well, you know, you're 100% correct. And it is the single biggest challenge of what we do. It is like a recovering alcoholic. Often his worst enemies are his best friends.
Yeah, yeah.
Because they don't want him to they want him to come drinking with him.
Mm-hmm.
They don't like the fact that he's now. For me, the solution is to form bands of brothers. You know, when guys go back, they need a community of like-minded men who've also been through the transformation, who they can hang out with. You know, it's that old thing, you know, show me your friends, I'll show you your future. Who do you hang out with? And the communities in which – and that's why we need to start organic movements. Movements of men. You know what's been encouraging to me is pretty much every man I've worked with, and we've worked with men throughout South Africa, from executives in corporates to homeless men in shelters – men want to be good men. They want to be good men, but they don't know how to be good. And the external influences of their friends are enormous. So if a boy grows up without a father or alternatively a good male mentor, where do they look? You know, they look to the gangster on the street corner. They look to media, which often has a very distorted message of masculinity, which are, you know, sadly embodied by men and women in the community. You know, a lot of women have the same message to men. You know, unless you're earning the bread, you know, I don't want you. So one almost needs, well, one does need an organic movement of men, starting with humanity. And going back to what you said, you know, all of us are human first. And that's our most primary and important identity. Before you're a man, you're a human being. And that is the most important thing. Before any woman's a woman, she's a human being. And yet there are flavors of humanity, and masculine and femininity are flavors. And masculine traits are predominantly or far more prevalent in biological males than women. But it's beautiful because the world needs it. And feminine traits are predominantly found in biological women. But the dance between these two things is such a beautiful thing. You think about, you and I exist because a man got together with a woman and they conceived us. Both brought their essence and we were created. And I think if we can really get human first, but masculine and feminine dancing, respecting, loving, working together, man, we can create a beautiful world. But it does need to, we need to change the ecosystem, man.
So two interesting things. I would like to hear your opinion on this. So I did a talk at the presidency at one stage with the men in the presidency. It's about 40 people in the room. So I asked them to write down on a piece of paper, what's the worst thing about being a man, anonymously. And when I collect them all up, 90% said being a provider.
Right. It is the hardest thing about being a man.
Yes. I think I phrased it, what's the worst thing? Not the hardest,
the worst.
So you've got a whole lot of people who hate having to be the provider, but aspiring to be the provider, which must cause a hell of an internal knot.
Yeah.
So you know what I mean? It's like it was very interesting to me to think of the most powerful men in the country. Their biggest hate is having to provide.
Well, right.
One could make jokes about that politically, and when you say the merging of both masculinity and femininity, I did say Silver tried to hijack the concept, but let me explain it again. So I posited that there is the voice of a woman in every man. There has to be. How can there not be?
Sure.
But that is stifled by this idea of wanting to be, needing to be a real man, or for the world to see me as a real man. So, and what is that voice? You can chart those sort of more caring attributes, or like you say, that what men can be and are. But as a story, that shows you that there is something inside you that's really good, but you yourself are not letting it come out. So, like you say, that's why these workshops have to be so tough, because you have to break down people's individual, voluntary shoving down of things that are inside them, and. I will never stop this work, nor will you, I can see, but it's never going to end.
No, it's,
and like you said, organic group, it's a question of developing groups that grow on their own, that don't need, that's the kicker. And you need a critical mass.
You do need a critical mass. But, you know, to address your point, I think because, you know, men say that that's the worst part of being a man, because there's a tremendous fear that if I can't provide, I'm less of a man.
Yes.
I'm not a real man. And I think that's something we need to really address, particularly in South Africa. Because let's be honest, you know, with our unemployment rates up near the 40%, there are a lot of men who will possibly never be employed.
Yeah.
Does that make them less of a man? No, it doesn't. It doesn't. And I think this is – so even you and I as men, if we're honest with ourselves, if I had to lose my ability to provide, it would be utterly devastating. It is devastating because
– not experienced it, surely?
I've experienced a bankruptcy. I've experienced a bankruptcy. And I mean, the devastation to your psyche is enormous, because you feel less of a man. You feel inadequate. You feel – I've had friends commit – I've literally had friends commit suicide because they lost all of their financial provision. And they felt that they were a useless father and a useless – husband, because they couldn't provide. Now, that's a dreadful lie. I think, you know, to take that further, you're a useless man if you're not doing your best to be a net good to society. You know, if you just give up and you lie on your bed and you consume and take and you abuse, you know, that's not masculine. But if you're out of work and you aren't earning an income, you can still use your masculine strength and energy and drive to add tremendous value to society. But a lot of men judge themselves purely, and a lot of women judge men purely on their basis of their ability to provide. And I think that's the fear. That's the real fear, that if I lose that, I lose everything. But it's a lie.
Yeah, your identity is tied up in falsehoods.
Correct.
That's what's going on.
Yeah.
And it's very fragile. It's very fragile state to live like that. If your life is based on those things that you have been told are
Your job is your life. You lose it, you lose life. I mean, that's if you boil it down to the basic essence. That's what it is to a lot of men.
And I think education's got a lot to do with that. Or not formal schooling education, but I mean, you need to be exposed to the variance of personality or of feelings, you know, because that will make you bulletproof to these practical lulls that you might have. But it's incredible, as you know, it's very quick. There's been times in my life where I've been unemployed, and it's very, very the decline. Until you check it.
You can go to a dark place very quickly, can't you?
Mm.
You know, there's a beautiful story, which for me just absolutely is the antidote to this. There was one of our mentors who was speaking to a female judge. I might have told you the story.
Mm.
Who had reached the top of her career. And he asked her, you know, what do you attribute your success to? And she actually teared up and she said, my father. And she said, my father was a poor man. He said, at times we lived in a shack.
Mm.
For years he was unemployed. But he was absolutely always present for me. When I got up in the morning, he had gotten up before me and prepared breakfast and whatever. When I came home from school or college, he was there to meet me. And she attributed her success to him, and he had no money. But he did his very – he was present. He was engaged. That is a real man. If you want to go back to the term, and that's phenomenal what men can do. We see men in communities and societies. They're not employed, but they are leaders of men's forums. They're doing phenomenal things in the community. And I think that's the message that – if our self-esteem's tied up in our ability to earn an income and then we lose that, someone once said, you know, you can judge the character of a man by what remains if you take everything away from him.
Mm.
I would probably fail that test right now because for me, it is tied up in my ability to, but I'm aware of that. And I think if more men have that sense of validity and legitimacy, not linked to their financial position, as you said, they'd be bulletproof. Because you can do anything externally and you can't. But bloody hell, that's difficult, isn't it?
Mm.
To get that right.
And I think I'm glad we're talking about our own misfortunes, be they financial. I'm glad we're talking about that because I think that's the only methodology you can use to reach into a man is to not confess. That's another concept.
Be real about our stuff.
But I mean, that's why our training works because we do show our vulnerability and we're not sort of reticent about it. We share our own failings. So then when you do that, then somebody will come. But they just won't. They won't just do it by asking them to do it. You've got to show them that it happened to you. You know, maleness happened to me.
Well, it's just that, isn't it, Tulani? I mean, there's a dreadful fear that if I share this, I'm going to be considered less than. If I share this weakness, this vulnerability, I'm not no longer a real man. But the reality is every single man has this stuff in their lives.
But I mean, overlay it with living with HIV.
Yeah.
So now you got a double whammy.
Right. These are the men you're dealing with.
So you have to understand the double whammy with all those mistruths that makes men not take treatment, you know, because it's representing failure. It's representing loss. That's what, I mean, we've done a lot of research. Fear of losing, you know, status, sexual prowess, respect in the community, you know, all those things. But when you flip that, my God, that's when you get who coaches.
Mm.
So coach walks into a community now and he's openly living with HIV and he's a man and he's confident. Just witnessing that power is transformational,
fantastic.
You know? But the trouble is going to scale. How do we go to scale with this? Because, like you say, it's a humbling experience when you come across these guys who are unemployed and they're doing amazing things and they're, you know, but we need to scale quickly.
But you know, Tulani, for me, I mean, and I think what you're saying confirms it, it's all inside of us as men, isn't it? It's inside. So if inside I have a deep sense of validity, legitimacy, self-esteem, belief in self, I am bulletproof in the sense that you can say anything to me. And I want you to like me, but if you don't, it doesn't change. You know, you can insult me. A woman can, and I mean, women have a lot more power than they realize. You know, women with their tongues can shred a man to pieces. You know, so if a woman does that, a woman says no to me, it doesn't matter because I know who I am.
Mm.
So I think the work that needs to be done, and I don't see this being done anywhere. It's all external. It's all this is how you need to behave, but it's not. What do you truly believe about yourself?
Mm-hmm.
You know, what is your narrative about who you are, about what masculine is? If we get that right, and for me, both you and us are doing what these healing dialogues, we're seeing phenomenal transformation. You know, on this camp we just did this weekend with men from Khayelitsha, men were sobbing.
Yeah.
And what blew me away and touched us so deeply was, you know, a man would start telling his story in front of his peers, in front of 60 other men. He'd break down and cry.
Yeah.
You'd expect those men to almost be derisive. No, no, no. There was a guy next door who quickly went and got some water for this guy. There's another guy who got a tissue.
Yeah.
There were two men that came and put their arms around a man.
Yeah.
You know, so men want to be good men. Men want to be real, but they're scared of it because it all starts with this, I don't believe I'm man enough. I don't believe I got what it takes. If we can heal that. And I think we can do it on a mass scale through dialogues. You know, not everyone has the resources or the time to go to a counselor. And often that counseling takes forever. But those healing dialogues, men in conversation are powerful.
I also think playfulness has a very good effect. And we have a lot of play in our trainings. Just men having a whole lot of fun without alcohol, we often say. But we kind of... hijack them into the fun. We have exercises that on the face of it seem frivolous, but they're deep beyond. I'll give you an example. We do something called the hot seat.
Yes.
Where somebody sits in the middle, so he's surrounded by about 20 men, and then questions are asked, but the group answers them, not the man. So you say things like, does this guy pray? Then the room will respond.
Based on their impression of
them. Yeah. After 2 days of knowing them, you know?
Right.
Does he keep his place tidy? And then more stronger, is he faithful? Is he ever violent? So the group, so you get an idea sitting in the hot seat, oh my God, this is what people think of me.
Yeah.
Then you get an opportunity to say what your truth is. Mm. And so that seems like a playful kind of almost, what was it called? It roasting in a way.
Yeah.
Seems like that, but it's actually very deep, for instance. And then as the facilitator, you look at where there's great disparity. So, and the biggest one that comes over is pray. Does this guy pray? The whole group will say, not a chance. This guy never would pray, right? Then when you ask him, he says, I get up at 3 and 5 to pray.
Yeah.
And then, but then as a facilitator, you say, what's going on then? You are a prayerful man, but you're not signaling that you're a prayerful man to anyone in the room.
You're hiding it in a way.
So what's going on there? Mm. So it's a fun exercise.
Yeah.
Honestly, it's a lot of fun because you can judge people in a safe space. Do you know what I mean? Does he play sport? Mm-hmm. Do you know what I mean? You'll get a guy who's a bit overweight and they'll say, not a chance. You know, and then when you ask him, it's like, I used to be like a Premier League soccer player. So our training sort of, it's stealth. I call it stealth training.
Yeah.
So you do an exercise that seems like that, but actually is doing that.
It's fantastic. It's cutting through all the bullshit, isn't it?
I
do a similar thing with men in corporates, you know, executive men. I get a group of men, we take group, what we call bands of brothers or allies in action.
Yeah.
And I get men to do slightly different. And I'm going to I'm going to steal that if you don't mind.
I
get them to tell their story. And you'll have men, for instance, in the bank recently who've worked together for 10 years. And I get them to tell their story. And I say, we don't want to know your biographical details. What were your biggest challenges, your biggest pains, your biggest disappointments, the things that you're most proud of? And when men tell these stories, often it's tearful. But what happens is you'll have two men that have worked together for 10 years and suddenly their relationship and their respect enters an entire different dimension because they didn't know anything about that.
Yeah.
You get men who are brought up in rural areas who've had tremendous difficulties in life, men who grew up in a township where there were 10 people living in a shack, no bedrooms, and suddenly the colleague who grew up in a very privileged, you know, has tremendous newfound respect for the challenges that this guy went through. So, I mean, breaking through the bullshit and the facade and the pantomime, as you call it, is powerful.
I mean, I don't want to just spend the whole time exchanging methodologies, but maybe that's a good thing. I don't know.
Yeah.
So our version of that is when people come in, either for workshops or for the training, coach training, is you name yourself by your passion. Okay. So there's no names used. Yeah. It's just, so you might say rock climbing, or mm-hmm. we don't allow family, church, those are too high. Yeah. But we want, you know, stuff you'd end up getting on your gravestone, like loved solo. Yeah. Mine's always potatoes. Yeah. But and then that if you're sharing your passion with people, then you can connect better with people. Yeah. And then it just sets up the training for a much more real interaction. Because most people want to say their qualifications and what they do and all that stuff.
Exactly. The external stuff.
And that's, it's just not important. Yeah. So I think I'm glad, you and I are doing things like that. But it's you've tried yourself. Go out there, try and find out how many other people are doing that. You look at me.
But, you know, Tulani, how can we challenge those listening into this to say, guys, first let's challenge the men. You know, I mean, I say to men, you're valuable. Your life matters. You count. You know, someone once said that every suicide is like a suicide bomber because of the lives it affects so terribly negatively by. But men committing suicide don't know how valuable they are. They don't know how much they mean. So the starting point is to say, man, your life counts, man. You're valuable. You have the power to impact everyone around you. Every relationship you're in, you have the power to make that person feel good about themselves or bad. You know, you can lift up and you can destroy. You mustn't be passive. You must be actively engaged in using whatever resources you have, whatever power and influence to make the world a better place. You know, so I mean, for me, that's the starting point to realize our value and import as men. And it's not linked to our ability to earn income. So I mean, would you say that's a starting point? I mean, we're going to go on to more challenges which are more deep.
It is. Well, as you were speaking, I was just thinking, it's almost like having a habit, being the man habit, you know, and like all habits, they're hard to
cultivate.
To stop the habit of being a man, right? That's why I was talking about the follow-up groups. Like you say, your band of brothers, you can, I mean, I smoke too much. I smoke cigarettes. I can stop. I stop in a 30-hour flight. Do you know what I mean? But then context wise, you know, it's how do you keep the nudges going after this insight that you are important, that you are valuable, that you have, you know, a hero, as you put it, in yourself. So that's where my main focus is. We have developed a methodology that works. That's great. But what's going on after that click?
Well, absolutely. But I mean, if we say to men, look, if men get to the point of realizing my life counts, I'm valuable, I'm the real deal, I'm legitimate. The next step is to say, well, your life has a story. You have a history which has woundedness in it, has tragedy, has things that have hurt you. Maybe it's been bullying words, maybe an absent father, maybe a mom who was very critical, whatever it might be that have caused pain and hurt. And those things have triggers. You know, you might have had an abusive relationship. You might be you might be in a relationship with someone who's being abused, and you that affects you because that person's dealing. You know, whatever the case might be, every one of us has those issues in our lives, and as a result, there's pain, and we need to deal with it. So the next thing to say to men is put a mirror in front of you, deal with your shit, deal with whatever stuff has been in your history that's caused pain, and now you anesthetizing it, whatever the case may be. You know, it can be a woman, it can be pornography, it can be gambling, it can be obesity, whatever it is that we, you know. And leading on from the pain, you've got to ask yourself, you men have got to say to yourself, well, what am I doing? What currently am I doing in my life that's not ideal, that's not optimal, that's destructive to my health or to the health of others as a result of that pain? You know, that's the next question, isn't it?
I do like that phrase, although I say, but hurt people hurt people. It's the very 100%, one of the most simplest
and we hurt ourselves
ways
too.
Of putting it. Yeah. And I often say, when people say, "Oh, what goes on in counseling?" To me, counseling is just exercising those ghosts. It's like saying, "That's not yours. Yeah. That was never yours.
Yeah.
That happened to you." Mm-hmm. It's sort of almost like chipping away the calcium of experience to the point where you can experience your natural self.
Right. Be healed. You know? Be restored.
I went to the Lion Park yesterday, which I recommend, in Rand Park. Was it? I think Randburg. Where is it? I don't know.
At Muldersdorf, where, I think.
Yeah, yeah. But it's a very slick operation, really impressive. But I was sort of, the odd thought came into my head about gender norms. Do you know what I mean? In the animal kingdom, as we drove past this.
They're very evident there, aren't they?
Very. They are with the lions, they were. With the zebras, they weren't. The zebras were just like totally in a weird, chilling atmosphere, chill zone. Yeah. But it was just an interesting thought that it was going on in my head about that. Like, animals aren't concerned with gender norms.
Well, the lion
they
kingdom
just do them.
In particular, I mean, the lion, the male lion is much bigger, much stronger than the female, and doesn't do much of the hunting, but is equipped with this incredibly mane, and its primary role is protecting the pride. You know? So it goes with venom after hyenas or any, you know, when encroaching on its territory, and fulfills that role in a very powerful way. And it creates the space where cubs are able to be born in safety. And it's a beautiful role. It's beautiful, you know. No one is more important or less important, but they are different roles. But you know that question of saying to men, you know, look at the stuff in your life that's driving behavior that's less than ideal, because you cannot stop the addiction without dealing with the driving root cause of what is leading to that addiction. Can you?
Self speak. Those things get into your head and then you end up perpetuating them in yourself. You know, what do you think about culture and masculinity? What can we say about that? Well, because there are very different cultures, have very different norms, right?
They do. Look, I believe that the drivers of the masculine body, mind, heart, soul are pretty standard throughout the world, but the manifestations culturally are very different. I'm also of the belief that not all cultures, we almost hold culture as the sacred thing, that all cultures are sacred.
Yeah.
But some cultures are very destructive. You know, if you take, you know, let's go back to the ancient Chinese culture of binding women's feet. I mean, utterly destructive, you know.
Mm.
You go to the culture of, which happens throughout, in many places, Ethiopia, of female circumcision.
Yeah.
Utterly. So we cannot look at culture and say, because it's your culture, it's okay. No, we can't, you know. We got to look at culture and say, well, let's examine culture in the light of what's humanly good. But you look at, almost every culture has some masculine traditions. You know, British culture, arm wrestling, you know, I mean, it's a big thing. Wrestling is a big thing. And often and stick fighting in Zulu culture. But often these are very, very healthy expressions because they're in a controlled environment. There are rules and regulations, and there are ways for men to express and grow their ability to be men without harming or hurting. And it's controlled. Roughhouse play with fathers and sons is crucial. You know, you see it in the animal kingdom. It teaches boys how to utilize their masculine energy.
Roughhouse play.
Yeah.
I've never heard of that one. That's true.
Yeah. Roughhousing. Yeah. You know, I mean, men wrestling with their sons.
Mm-hmm.
You know, my son ended up he won the South African under 18 jiu-jitsu competition. He got his colors in. You know, I mean, and that's when I first looked at that sport. I mean, it's about overcoming the man, but it's there are rules and regulation. There's honor and there's respect. So it's controlled. And I think truly masculine men have a form of controlled aggression in the sense of they're anti things that are bad. And that's the whole premise of this podcast. Let's be dangerous. But never to each other as men, never to a woman, never to children. Let's be dangerous to whatever is a threat to society. So let's be dangerous to racism.
Mm.
Let's not tolerate it.
Mm-hmm.
But in order to do that, you need an influence. You need the ability to be assertive against that. So I think training, it's a very long answer to your question about culture.
Yeah.
I think culture is very good at creating methodologies and ways for men to grow in their masculinity without being destructive in their masculinity.
And then some cultures aren't. Some parts of that culture aren't. And I agree with you. I don't think cultures often use it as a defense to perpetuate not good behavior.
Well, it's politically correct to say culture is sacrosanct, isn't it?
Yeah.
And it's not.
It's complicated. Because there's some things which are valuable and there are some things that totally should be thrown out.
Correct.
And the trouble is, as a culture, they could get conflated. So this has to go together. It'd be great to sort of analyze each culture and just take good, chuck good, but like that's not going to happen. Again, we're thinking massively big stuff here with cultural transformation, I do believe, as you say, some people just if that's your culture, that's the way you're going to behave.
And it's
another self speak. It's another self speak.
Well, we've Look, I don't think this is. Culture also becomes bastardized, doesn't it? It becomes corrupted. So, for instance, the culture of Lobola, whatever you think about it in India, it's what do they call it?
Bride price.
Yeah, exactly. That traditionally is used as a way of merging families, as a way of showing that, you know, our families are coming together. It's a very positive thing.
Mm.
But it can be used now as a sense of ownership. Mm. I paid for you, therefore I own you. Then I can do whatever I want. Mm. So often people, you know, I've come from a Judeo-Christian background. You know, there's a whole thing, you can use biblical verses to justify dominating a woman.
Mm.
Completely distorted use of scripture.
Mm.
You know, so often people use culture incorrectly. They distort it to justify dominating whatever the bad things that they want to do. So I think one has to look at that very carefully as well.
Yep. There's lots of work to be done. But remember, like I said before, we had a little chat about the goldfish story. Mm-hmm. That's the way you have to proceed. And the goldfish story, for anyone who doesn't know it, is two friends walk along the beach and then millions of goldfish are washed up on the shore and they're going to die. And the friend goes in and chucks one back into the water. And then the friend goes, but that's not going to make a difference. And then the guy goes, I can assure you it makes a difference to
that one.
So I think going forward, we have to kind of go forward with like one by one by one.
Absolutely.
Because you're not going to – mass media campaigns are not going to cut it.
No.
Or any kind of theoretical campaign isn't going to cut it. Transformation happens very intimately.
And as you said, you know, if you make a difference to that one, there's a domino effect, isn't there?
Yeah.
Now, you transform one man, he goes back to the community. That affects his family, his wife, his sons, whatever. And we can begin to create a domino effect and hopefully at some point critical mass. But I'd love to go back to, you know, you and I as men challenging the men out there to say, well, how do we deal with this as an individual? You know, believe you're valuable, that you really matter, that you count. Look in the mirror. Look at your history and look at the things that really hurt you and damage you. Look at your behavior now. What are you doing that's not optimal, that is destructive? Number four, get help and find like-minded people that you can say, well, I'm going to commit. Because the question is, what kind of man do you want to be? Now, that's a good question to ask men. You know, at the end of your life and looking back, what kind of man do you want to be? Because, you know, I think we talked earlier sort of in different terminology, but, you know, growing up as a kid, someone else holds the pen that writes your story. But there's some point where the pen gets put into your hands and my hands. And we've got to say, well, what kind of man do I want to be? Let me write that story. You know, is my behavior today leading to the kind of life and man that I want to be? That happened to me as a father. You know, I realized with my daughter and son, they needed me to be a good man, a man who was engaged and involved. But not only engaged and involved, but also to live a life that emulated what the kind of man, for instance, my daughter would marry one day, the kind of man my son would be. And that was an inspiration to just get my shit together, get my life together. And it was a long journey because, you know, we arrive at adulthood wounded. I did. You know, how do we fix all that stuff so that we can become that man?
It is, I mean, like, cut. Can you cut?
Absolutely. Yeah, we end up this all the time.
No, you said you were wounded, right? Mm. So I honestly, and you use that woundedness, I'm sure, in your work. And but that's what I'm saying is the only way to begin the communication is to start where it hurts with another man.
Yeah.
But if you go out and just say, examine your shit, work about your shit, men will say, I've got no shit, man. Exactly. What are you talking about?
Exactly.
You're the pushback. Because part of the wrong way of looking at man's masculinity is the pushback. Mm-hmm. It's not the open look at me.
Yeah, yeah.
It's the pushback. So that's why I say it's very intimate stuff, this rejigging or this insight provoking.
It is.
You know? Then Michael Jackson, take a look at yourself and make a change. Not that. It's not like that. That's a song.
And that's so theoretical, isn't it?
Yeah. So I think and you have soldiers, and I've got soldiers. I'm using a war analogy, not soldiers. What's a better word for them?
Friends, soldiers is a good word. I mean, you can have a righteous war, you know? I mean, we're fighting a good fight.
The cascade, what I'm saying, and we've got to do that. Mm. We've just got to develop a critical mass of soldiers.
Absolutely.
For want of a better word.
And again, it's reclaiming words that have been misused. And, you know, I mean, isn't it true? The best generals are those who hate war,
yeah.
who love peace, peace through strength. You know, sadly, we're living in a world where evil exists and you need soldiers to resist it. You don't want them to fight, but you want them to be able to fight. It's that whole thing of never start a fight, but be able to finish one if it comes your way.
But enough about silver. No. I'm sure Silver wouldn't mind me sharing this, but they're after years of Silver's kind of like that kind of superhero. He'll engage if he has to, if it's to stop a wrong. And he was at the traffic lights the other day because not the traffic lights. He stopped because some cyclists were driving past, but the car behind didn't see the cyclists. So they were just beeping and going crazier and crazier. So I was shouting things, you know, and Silver was just letting the cyclist pass. And then this guy in the car behind him got out and walked towards Silver, obviously like he was going, well, I don't think he did when he saw how high.
he's a big man.
His height. But, and then Silver says, he describes this, he says he just saw sheer pain in the, like fear in the guy's eyes. Mm. But the guy had already set himself up to go and do this. And then so Silver just put his hand out for a handshake and pulled him in.
Fantastic.
And the other guy started crying, you know, like, and Silver said, it doesn't, I know it's a bit corny. He said, no, it doesn't have to be this way. And then the guy wants his number, he wants his phone, he wants him to meet the family. So now doing that is you become a celebrity just doing that. But it's a nice story. You know what I mean? The way it did end.
You know, Talani, wouldn't it be beautiful if we could use the term real man and say that that's a real man? That's a real man who used his strength for good, who could have beaten the guy because he was showing aggression, but showed him love instead. I mean, that for me is masculinity. It's strong, but it's used in the right fashion. And man, if we can develop that within ourselves, you know, grow our strength, know our strength, but only use it for good. That is a beautiful thing.
To me, it's the thermostat. It's having a thermostat that you can control.
Yeah,
you know, and where did we go wrong? Where so many people don't have, they just have on off.
Yeah,
and
well, isn't it ultimately a lack of proper fathering and mentoring and nurturing from, you know. Young boys look to older men to teach them what it means to be a man. I often say to people, and it can be so offensive. I've had so much kickback on this. As a father, I cannot teach my daughter how to be a woman. I can teach her how to be a human, but there's certain things that, you know, she needs to be modeled. As my wife cannot teach my son how to be a man. She can teach him pretty much everything about how to be a human, how to be loving, caring. But the elements of manhood that my son needs me, you know, because a woman doesn't experience those things. So we need each other. Men and women are so crucial, both to boys and girls, to teach, nurture, model what it means to be a human and what it means to be a man and a woman. So these young guys growing up with all the pain and the anger and the angst and they're not being mentored by men who are able to display to them, this is what it means to be a man.
Mm. I mean, you are quite strong on your sort of man and woman. I don't really take that approach. I sort of leave it at the personhood and the humanity. But that's not to say I'm not disagreeing with you, but my sort of paradigm or approach is kind of when you say like a woman couldn't teach a boy how to be a man. I don't know. My jury's out on that. I know what you're saying. You're saying a message underneath it, or a man. I mean, I've got a friend, the jazz pianist, who's growing up three teenage girls, and he lives with them. I've got amazing respect for him, and the kind of interactions I see him with them is, I mean, he's a musician, so his worldview is quite poetic. It's quite, you know, dreamy, impractical sometimes, you know what I mean? But they will be the woman they will become, carrying a lot of his ideas, his, you know, the way he sees the world and the qualities of the qualities that people have. And so I don't think he's teaching them to be women, but I think he's teaching them to be very good humans.
Well, that's exactly what men and women can do. I mean, I was a single dad. You know, when a girl gets to the point of menstruation, dealing with premenstrual stress and tension, when it gets to the point of, you know, first sexual experiences, you know, these are things that are very unique to women.
Yeah.
And as a man, I don't know them. You know, I cannot understand birth. I can't. So for me to try and counsel a woman through birth pains, no, I cannot do that.
Yeah.
You know, when a young boy grows up and his hormones are raging and he's starting getting a hard on every morning, there's no way a woman can understand that and teach him that. So, I mean, there are things that men need men for and girls.
No, there are, of course.
And so that's what I'm saying. I mean, the humanity side, I 100% agree with you, you know, teaching empathy and compassion.
What did you do then? What did you do? How did you navigate that?
Well, I navigated it as much as I possibly could. I mean, fortunately, I have a brilliant, beautiful relationship with my daughter. She's now 28. She tells me everything and shared everything with me. And you know,
no, but I mean, how did you deal with the onset of menstruation? Did you have an aunt?
Get women involved. And that's why I encourage single moms, even though many of them are doing an outstanding and heroic job, get men involved in their sons' lives, whether it's an uncle, a brother, a grandfather, as much as possible, the biological father, if that's possible. But get men involved, send them to Boy Scouts, do whatever, you know, because they were going to need that. You know, if you want to teach your boy to be able to be vulnerable and to be able to cry, and they're only woman in his life, and they demonstrate that crying is okay, he's going to say, well, you're a woman, you can cry. He needs a man to demonstrate also. So it's very crucial, you know, and that's the whole village, takes a village to raise. We need each other. There are things, too, that I need to teach my daughter that my wife can't. In other words, for instance, how I treat women as a man is going to be a powerful message to my daughter as to what she should accept and not accept. You know, so these things are absolutely crucial. You know, we need men and women teaching boys and girls to grow up to be beautiful human beings, male and female.
Yeah. I used to celebrate when my son cried.
Yeah, it's wonderful. Yeah. But you probably demonstrated to him that it was okay.
Yeah.
You see? So he saw a man doing that. You modeled healthy masculinity to him and he followed that, you know?
Yeah, I mean, that's it's important. Hooking up a single mother with a son, and I'm sure you definitely have to find the right man.
Yeah, absolutely. But you see, what we've done is thrown the baby out of the bathwater. You know, we've said, particularly women who've been hurt by men, in a very real, authentic, you know, legitimate, there's an anger and resentment, understandably so. But a woman who's growing up angry and resentful against men is not going to impart a healthy message to her son about men. She's likely going to give him the impression that men are bad, and because he's a man in the making, that he's bad. You know, I mean, this is all subliminal, and he's going to grow up trying to be as feminine as he possibly can and possibly hating himself as a man and rejecting manhood. So it's very crucial that, and that's a woman dealing with her stuff, even though she was hurt and it's not her fault at all, dealing with it is so crucial for the next generation, for us as men. You know, you get this whole incel movement and the manosphere. A lot of that's driven by anger and hatred, and it's inappropriate and it's wrong. You know, you get the Andrew Tates of the world and, you know, who are spewing out a very angry, toxic type of masculinity. That's a backlash out of pain and woundedness and hurt. And so the need for us to find wholeness and a celebration of the feminine, a celebration of the masculine, and this weaving together, as you put it, is so absolutely crucial.
I'm curious, how much did the guys this weekend did women come up as a sort of topic in their lives? How was the what was the talk about women like for these guys?
Well, almost inevitably, South African men, a lot of them are raised by moms. So their moms are their heroes. Their gorgos or grandmothers are their heroes. Tremendous amount of hurt from a lack of fathers, absent fathers or abusive fathers, tremendous amount. Also tremendous amount of anger towards women because a lot of them had been let down by women. A lot of this, the employment thing, you know, some of the men had lost their jobs and been vilified by women and cut to shreds by women. there were women involved in their lives that were in a parental alienation, you know, holding the kids back from them and not allowing them. So women came up a lot. You know, women have tremendous power in the life of a man to heal and to hurt. So that was, but you know, the single mom is often touted as the hero, as the person who's just, or the grandmother who taught me life, who saved my life, you know, so glowing terms about that. So mixed bag.
Yeah. Is it a once-off? I know I'm asking you a question, but is it a once-off training or a
no, it's ongoing. Experience?
It's ongoing.
Yeah, very much so. Good, so these were men we want to become mentors in the community. And most of them were recruited from men who were police constables, teachers, you know, men who had some kind of influence. But we've encouraged, we've got a social media group in Khayelitsha going, and each of these men are linked to an organization within Khayelitsha that we relate to, like an NGO or a church or something. And they will become this band of brothers now. And they'll be tasked with running dialogues for other men and also tasked with forming bands of brothers, support, small groups, 10, you know, that continue support. So, you know, we can't drive all of that directly, but the hope is that there's momentum for that to take place.
Momentum.
Indeed, yeah. Oh, Tulani, any closing words from you? It's as you say, deep and intimate, and
I don't know. I think you've got to keep questioning yourself in the context of trying to help other men, because if you don't, then you'll become disconnected and you become a I don't know, like a priest of some sort, or you know. I think so. Keeping real is important to me, and not. And speaking a real language, you know, about my own vulnerabilities, you know, with them, I think it's a temptation to feel overly prideful at the work one does. Do you know what I mean? Like, oh, I've got the secret to making you a better man. But so I think I start with myself. I'm constantly monitoring myself, whether I'm spinning a lie. You know what I mean? It's like men are innately amazing bullshitters to themselves. I mean, it's incredible. And we all know it. So I try to check my own bullshitting of myself. So that, you know, those men I work with check theirs, because they can come out, you know, and we do those things. We do those things in that hot seat, you know. Is he faithful, you know? And a guy can say yes.
He's lying.
Of course he's lying. But put him on a lie detector test.
Yeah, he'll fail it.
No, the line won't go up. Such is the power of his self.
Because he believes
of killing himself. Yeah, exactly.
Yeah.
So, I want to keep my feet on the ground with working with men, and I want to just keep going. But my frustration, like we've agreed on, is scale, and the waste of resources that are being allocated towards things like GBV. It's not being steered by a very wise.
No.
Approach. It's a real blunderbuss approach, and it's not helpful.
It's not healing, then, is it?
No.
It's not. Well, I think your commitment to self-awareness and vulnerability is what makes you good at what you do, because without that, it's entirely superficial and entirely theoretical and external. So I'm fully in agreement with you. And in a way, having walked this journey that we have, it's almost impossible to become arrogant and pride in one sense that you know. You know the bullshit. You know, someone once said the biggest lie that men tell is, I'm fine.
Yeah.
And part of that's external pressure to be fine.
Mm.
You're not allowed to not be fine. You have to hold it together for your kids and for society and for each other as brothers, because we're bad at that, aren't we, for each other? You know, we posture and pose in front of each other, don't we? You know, you ask a guy, how many press-ups can you do? He's going to exaggerate, you know. How many women have you slept with? He's going to... And I mean, it's bullshit, because that's not really what makes us men. So I really honor that authenticity. And I mean, this is all about, you know, I mean, I can say this with absolute sincerity to you. You are dangerous to toxic masculinity. You are. And I applaud you for that and honor you for that. And I think that's our goal, to be dangerous to what's bad for society and a powerful force for good, for what's good. And, you know, you're doing
it. But it's very dangerous. It's dangerous to be dangerous in this country.
Yeah. In what sense?
It's Well, it's physically, literally dangerous to challenge it, some toxic experience with another man. It's not, like I said, 0 to 1,000 in South Africa. You're dealing with your physical safety, and you've got to be very sophisticated to even cut a little, you know, niche just to get through to somebody who you think. But I don't walk around like the Messiah. Like, I'm perfect on everything.
No, we're not.
But I often think I've been so challenging because Silver's standing behind me in the training. I'm not too sure I'd take on the bodyguards without him behind me. But,
haven't you found that most men you deal with want to be good men?
Oh, of course.
There's a hunger.
Oh, yeah.
There's a cry in men, you know?
Yeah.
I mean, I've been blown away at how quickly men break down and cry and weep because it's there, man. That facade is actually quite fragile, you know, and once you break through it and it comes out, it's very real.
Oh, yeah. Oh, totally. It's a pantomime.
Yeah, yeah.
Some of my best, I often say when I was a therapist, I was talented at making people cry, which is not a bad thing, but I used to go for the hardest ones, the skinheads.
Right.
You know British skinheads?
Yeah.
And they were the most lovely guy behind the front. Yeah. So yeah, I do like going in. I do like that, like being straight. But we're living in a culture of such competitive, you know, aggression, and it's the modeling. You look go up, up the chain politically, and then you know, so many moments happen that just take people back, like Will Smith slapping.
Yeah,
I mean, these things are important, you know.
Yeah, they're real. Well, those big lies, eh? Sex, power, money. Big boys don't cry. It all boils down to those four lies, eh? And I'm fine. You know, it's a big lie. But
I like your approach on your, especially your, I mean, I may have misgivings about the six pack, but the six, it's a very good idea. And I like the way you stick in it. You stay in lane.
Yeah.
You know, you've got a fundamental approach that is, I like it, you know, to be dangerous to the danger.
Mm.
It's that old phrase, isn't it? Good men to do nothing.
Yeah, exactly. Well, you know, the reality is if you tell a man that he's toxic or trash, chances are he's going to behave toxic. If you tell a man you're a hero, you're going to call that hero out on him. Men want to be dangerous. They want to be powerful. It's in our DNA, but we need to be powerful for good. And we're essentially doing the same thing in slightly different ways, you know, just calling men to a higher good.
I'm interested in your feelings about now same-sex behaviors, or there's so many LGBTIQ+1, 2. But how would you engage? How would you engage a man who consciously wants to be as unmanly as possible and even feminine? I'm not talking about transgender, but what's the conversation you have there? A guy who objects to every kind of masculine behavior that they're being given or want to give themselves. How do you approach that?
Well, the reality is men can be soft, caring, nurturers, and women can be powerful warriors. You know, it's not. And this thing is on a scale. And a man who's not what we call a traditionally masculine man, there's nothing wrong with that. If it's driven by hurt, which it can be, in other words, he's experienced the worst of masculinity, so he's rebelling against it. He hates it.
Yeah.
He probably hates himself. He hates anything masculine because masculinity has hurt him.
Mm.
A father's abandoned him or beaten him, and he's just seen the worst of it. You know, if it's driven by hurt, one has to heal that hurt.
Mm.
And there might be more masculine qualities in him that he hates, but it is him. If it's driven just by the fact that this is the dude, I mean, he's a dude who wants to be a florist and he wants to do ballet and he wants to play piano. He's not into the sport. I mean, that is one way of being a man. You know, there's nothing wrong with that. You know, I often talk to dads we often want to cookie cut our kids. You know, if I'm a rugby player, I want my boy to play rugby. You know, as a man.
Yeah, yeah.
And if he wants to be a ballet dancer, it might be difficult for me but I need to accept the fact that you know he's not. Like me, he wants to be that, and that's perfectly fine. As long as it's out of a place of wholeness and authenticity to who he actually is and not driven by hurt and a rebellion.
Mm.
I often get asked by gay men, you can imagine this conversation. You know, can I be a man? And I said, of course you can. I mean, what are you? You're a gay man. you're a gay man, which means you're a man. You know, and so it's not incompatible. You know, it's not. But there, one has to look at the woundedness. You know, in every man. You know, what of my behavior and my sense of identity is driven by anger, woundedness, rebellion, reaction to pain and trauma, and what of it is truly genuinely me?
It's a powerful word, woundedness.
Yeah, it is. And it's a real word for every one of us.
To be, you can't start with it. In terms of when you're doing not an intervention, a training or something, you can't start with it. You have to sort of peel.
You do, because men don't know slowly what it means.
Yeah. Peel. Do you think there's anybody that isn't wounded?
I don't think so. I think obviously it's degrees. You wanted to say something?
Yeah.
Is anyone?
I see him.
Yeah, he's shaking his head. No. No.
I don't think so.
But we're so good at hiding it.
Sure.
Because we deal with shit and becomes part of who we are. And it's, you know, there's that saying that says fish are often the last to perceive water because they're in it. It's part of their eco. And our woundedness is part of who we are. We don't perceive it. So to reveal it is quite a delicate process.
And what do you, I know, I think South Africa is particularly wounded.
Very much so.
Nation. I started my life in South Africa with the Truth and Reconciliation Commission, right, which I don't wear as a badge of honor, but it was an attempt to sort of say, look what happened. But it's incredibly wounded.
Very, very. I think the vast majority of South Africans carry PTSD.
Yeah.
And so this mass healing is needed. And we need to find a way of doing mass healing without each individual having to go for counseling. And I think hopefully we're moving in the right direction.
Yeah. You're talking mass healing. You think of the Pope. Do you think the Pope did a good job?
that's another whole story and debate we can go into. This is going into ideology in some very, I think often virtue signaling has become a major, major problem. You know, compassion. You know, this self-interest disguised as compassion.
Yeah,
is a huge thing. And we need to get away from that. But that's the topic of another discussion.
Yeah, yeah. I think that's a great discussion.
Yeah.
The righteous. Yeah. Yeah. Well, I've got a little badge above my desk, and it says, "What, save us from saviors."
Yeah. Exactly. 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 Yeah.
Anyway.
We're all wounded healers. We all, as you say, have had shit in our lives that has stuffed us up. And we need to deal with it. You know, and the more we make it legit to deal with and deal with it honestly, the better human beings we can be.
Mm. Yeah. And I'll finish on the phrase my son taught me, but it's not his. But it's your happiness is directly proportionate to the number of difficult conversations you have.
Yeah. I think that's very wise.
Which is like easy to say, but difficult to do.
Yeah.
I mean, you really have to go in to the difficulty to be happy. And some people can not have that conversation their whole lives.
Well, most of us don't. Because we've lived with it our whole lives. And we've had to cope and deal with it. And it becomes part of who we are. We say, well, it's okay. You know, a lot of people have a father wound. Either unaware of it or just justified. Oh, no, you know, that's okay. It's okay. But it's actually not okay.
Mm.
Because you're still carrying it. It's still driving behavior.
Mm.
And until you deal with the wound, the behavior is still going to continue.
Mm.
Yeah,
we so could much. Go. There's another Buddhist story about you're still carrying her, right? You know that one?
Yeah.
Was it the Buddha? Anyway, let's say just a guy, monk, whatever, is walking along, and then there's a woman who's trying to cross the river, and he knows she's going to ruin her whole outfit, whatever. So he picks her up. The guy is with a partner, picks her up, takes her over the river, and whatever. And then when they're on the other side of the river, the guy's friend goes, "How could you do that? You know, you're a monk. You're not supposed to even touch a woman. What were you thinking? I mean, like, what are you doing?" And then the monk says something like, "Okay, I put her on the other side of the. I put her. I dropped. Put her down on the other side of the river. You're still carrying her."
Yeah. Very true.
Anyway, no.
Tulani, great conversation, man. So much. I think we might have to have another.
Yeah, man. We might have to.
Yeah, yeah.
Even off site.
Absolutely.
Yeah, man.
But as men, we're designed to be a beautiful gift to society, but we need to heal ourselves. We need to look in the mirror, deal with the tragedy of our journeys, and deal with anything that we are doing currently that is not productive to ourselves and others. and be that man. Thank you, man.
Well done. Thanks, Craig.